Beer Talk. Gespräche über und beim Bier.
Hello and welcome to another episode of our podcast Beer Talk. Today I'm very happy to again go to the other side of the planet and where it's probably warmer than here because we have winter time here in Germany now. We are in California and I'm very happy to have Winnie Celurzo from Russian River here on air. And yeah, it's great that you are here and maybe you introduce yourself a little to our listeners.
Sure, of course. Well, first, it's great to be here. Happy to spend the next whatever amount of time is. I'm Vinny Celurzo, co-owner of Russian River Brewing Company. We are a craft brewery in the United States, specifically in California, and more specifically in Sonoma County. So that's about 50 or 60 kilometers north of San Francisco over the Golden Gate Bridge. So that means that anytime we go to San Francisco, my wife and business partner, Natalie, and I, we get to drive over the Golden Gate Bridge, which never gets old. So kind of a cool part of being here. We're right in the middle of wine country. So we have hundreds of wineries surrounding us, the Napa Valley and the Sonoma wine country. The name of our brewery, Russian River Brewing Company, comes from the actual river that runs through Sonoma County, and it's also the wine appellation here, which has a very similar climate to Burgundy in France. So we grow a lot of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So I'm as much of a wine drinker as I am a beer drinker, and our brewery has been open since 1997. So that makes us pretty historical in the current craft beer segment, where most breweries opened, you know, much more recently. And I've actually been in craft beer, microbrewed beer, as it was originally called, since 1994.
Yeah, that's a long time. And also, I'm very curious. I hope I will have the time to come to San Francisco and then the Bay Area in the next years. Good friend of me, Pete Slosberg, is always inviting me and treating me with chocolates and whatever, but maybe we will have the moment. Maybe to start right into the middle, for me, the most impressive moment when I had your beers was when I was in Las Vegas last year for the CBC and judging at the World Beer Cup, and I started exploring the city. And then I had a longer walk and I came to a place called Zombie Brewing or Zombies Brewing and looked a bit strange. It was behind a bridge. And then I went there and opened the door. And then there were three beers from Russian River on tap. I tried them all immediately and they were so fresh and crisp. And my first time and I had them on tap. And so I ultimately really fell in love. What do you think? Why is it like that? What do you think you are doing different to others?
Well, first off, Vegas is an interesting market for us. It's one of our smallest, if not our smallest market. And I'd like to think of it as a bit of a pressure relief valve, if you will. So if we ever have excess beer, it goes to Vegas. Vegas will get beer every month, but its volume fluctuates. And there's really only maybe six or eight places that sell our beer in Vegas on tap. So you just happen to stumble onto one of the very few. And then there's just a handful of accounts that sell it, you know, in a market, so off premise, so bottles or cans that you can take to go. So it's a very small market, but it's close to us, you know, from California. But for the freshness factor, you know, you kind of hit upon one of the cornerstones of our business and one of our ethos in our model that has always been there ever since, you know, the day that we opened, you know, two plus decades ago. And that is to focus on freshness. And, you know, obviously we have super high standards in the brewery and doing everything we can to make ultra fresh beer. So keeping oxygen levels really low and all the other things that go along with that. But, you know, one of the things that you hear a lot, at least here in the States, and I know in Germany, like most beer is not kept cold all the way through the distribution chain, but that's actually something that we can do here in the States if you put your mind to it. And that's something we do at Russian River. So, you know, once the beer comes off the packaging line, it immediately goes into a cold box. When we deliver it, our account, so we sell to about 500 accounts that we deliver directly to in the Bay Area. So that would be San Francisco, Oakland, and then up here in the area where we're at. So all the accounts that sell our beer are mandated by us, Russian River Brewery, to keep the beer cold. When we ship to a distributor, to a regional distributor, say in Southern California or maybe up to Oregon or Washington or to Colorado, we ship the beer cold there as well. And so the beer that you had in Vegas would have been shipped cold. And then we're only shipping as much, only enough beer for that distributor to sell in the following 3 to 4 weeks. And then they have to wait for the next shipment and they have to sell out of it. We also have, for the most part, a Russian River Brewery employee covering every market that we sell our beer in. And so their job is really less about selling beer and they're more a brand ambassador and a quality ambassador for freshness. And they're making sure that the stock is ultra fresh. And if they find old beer, like an old bottle of this or that, instead of doing the traditional way, which would be in the United States, where the distributor comes back in and buys back the beer from the account, and then they would split the loss of that beer that they didn't get to sell with the brewery. Our sales team, our brand ambassador team, our Russian River Brewery team that's out in the street, they just buy the beer right off the shelf. In fact, I was just up in Seattle 2 weeks ago brewing a beer with a friend doing a collaboration, and I was working the market the day before with our rep up there, and we found a few bottles of a pale ale of ours that was passcode, and Jeremy just bought them right off the shelf, and we walked out with 6 bottles of our beer that were out of code. To be honest with you, they were probably still in good shape, but that's just the ethos and values that we live by. And so that is one of the ways that we ensure that our beer is ultra fresh. And I often get texts from friends in Southern California that buy a bottle of our beer and they say, is this right? This was just bottled 5 days ago. And that is very common. And we often are taking pallets right off the packaging line and loading them right into trucks. And then they land at the distributor. And because we keep low inventories at the distributor, we get ultra fresh beer out into the market, even as a 50,000 barrel brewery, which is the size we are.
Isn't that maybe also the key factor in general for American IPAs? Because if I think in Germany, of course, we have great hops and great hop areas, but it takes a long time until the hop is harvested and then it's brought to cooperatives and then it's processed and whatever. And maybe it takes a year until breweries are really starting to brew. And so many IPAs we have here simply don't have the freshness already in the hops. And also then it takes a time to bring it to the markets, whatever. So many years ago when I was first time to Yakima Valley, that was same impression for me. I was there and the beers were so much more hoppy, intense, crisp, full of these fruity, pliny, zesty, whatever aromas. Is that maybe also some important part of the American IPAs?
When you're talking about IPA directly, and West Coast IPA or American IPA or hazy IPA, even the freshness of the hops is obviously a big deal. One thing that you'll find here in the States, in the major hop farms in the Pacific Northwest that you won't find for the most part, this is a generalization, for the most part, German farms, because most of them are so small, do not have cold storage on their facilities, whereas almost all the farms here in the States will have at least a small cold box. And they're also running their hops from their farm to whoever processes for them literally the same day, if not the same day, the next day that they were baled. And then from there, they're going right into cold storage. So that cold storage is something that's really a focus on the hop industry here and always has been. We are already brewing with crop year 2025 hops, so hops that were harvested just in, you know, early September this year. We're already brewing with some of those hops right now. So there is truly a freshness factor there. And although once you get hops into if your hops are pelleted, all else being equal, if they're pelleted and you store them at, you know, cold temperatures, say, I mean, our hop freezers are at are below freezing. So, you know, they're 25 degree Fahrenheit. So we're like -3°C or something like that. Anyways, if you cold store your hops and they're pelleted properly, they'll actually hold for several years. And that's pretty well accepted in the industry, whether you're in the US or Germany or wherever. But it's getting to that point and trying to get them there in a reasonable amount of time. We also use a fair amount of whole cone hops. And here in the States, whole cone hops are baled into 200 pound bales. So that is about 90 or 91 kilograms per bale. We actually will have those bales cut into quarter bales and then put into Mylar bags that are nitrogen flushed. And we do this because it preserves them a little bit better. So although it costs us a little bit more because we are using whole cone hops, it does help us there. So, yeah, from the IPA standpoint too, you also have to look at how they are stored and sold in the store. I say this all the time to our customers, you know, don't ever buy our IPA if you don't see it stored cold in the store. And 99% of the time it is. And that's what our sales team's main job is to drive quality with our retailer partners. But even if it's not Russian River, if it's a big brewery, big national craft brewery, or someone smaller than us, if that IPA isn't stored cold, don't buy it. That to me is the very first thing a consumer can do to, you know, protect their dollar and make sure that what they're buying is really fresh. And then second is when you buy that or look at that can or bottle of IPA in the store here, if it does not have a packaged on date, a bottled on or a canned on date, I wouldn't buy it either. As a consumer, I want to know when this beer was put into a can or bottle, and that will help drive my decision on how fresh you know, the beer is and if I want to buy it or not.
That's really impressive to hear, especially as we have the German perspective, and we had only one company which tried to start to have something like a cool chain and also fridges everywhere and trying to have a surveillance that is really kept cold. But in the end, it didn't work. The employees of these stores started storing their lunch inside of these fridges and not the beer. And so it was really, maybe it still has to be some time until this idea reaches Germany, whatever.
I'll also add that's the mindset for a lot of big breweries, big distributors here in the States as well. So that's not specific to Germany. And I see that everywhere in other countries that Natalie and I are fortunate enough to travel to. And so it takes a very special craft brewery in America, and it takes a lot of work to make that happen. But you can do it, but it does take an awful lot of work, and you have to be able to stand behind your values, your ethos, and your beer, and you have to be ready to buy it back when it's in cold storage still and is out of code. And that's something that we do, and really the values that we live by. And we're an IPA brewery first and foremost, and we do make you know, about 15%. So 15% of our production is lagers, a Pilsner and a Helles. But gosh, like 80% of our beers that we sell, produce and sell is IPA. So we live and die by the freshness.
Yeah, and you were just talking about the hop cones. So what is the contribution for you that you say, okay, I still want to use the whole hop cones in my product?
Yeah, so we use whole cone hops on the hot side. So we have a hop back or a hop jack, as it's called. So our brew house is Zeman, made by a German manufacturer there. we really absolutely love our Zeman brew house. And when we went to design the brew house with them, this was something that we asked them to do, and they were very open to do. We actually got pushback from some other brew house manufacturers when we were shopping this around. And in fact, Zeman had already done it once previous for another American brewery. So they had experience doing this when they installed the brew house at Carbach in Texas. And so what we do is we replace a lot of our Whirlpool hops, which traditionally would contribute to mostly just, you know, aroma on the hot side. And we switch those into whole cone hops and put them in a hop back. And so the wort, after it's done boiling in the kettle, and I will say that we use a lot of hop extracts, CO2 pure resin hop extract for bittering. That's something I've been doing since 1998, and I'm a firm believer in using this product. And then we're also using more advanced hop products on the dry hop side, which I know wouldn't be legal in Germany. I always talk to Eric Toft from Schoenrahmer about this, and he's always like, that's illegal. We can't do that here. But anyway, so that's some other stuff that we do that's downstream that we can talk about also. But back to the whole cone hop. So then when the wort transfers to the whirlpool, goes through the normal process in the whirlpool. And then from there, so there's very few pellets added in the whirlpool. From there, the wort is transferred and flows over the top of the whole cone hops in this hop back small vessel. And then the wort exits the vessel and then to a pump, and then the pump sends the wort, the unfermented beer, directly to the wort cooler. And the idea is that the wort is only in contact with the hops for maybe 5 minutes. And so this wort being in contact for the hops for a short amount of time still will extract the volatile and beautiful hop oils that we want, but then the wort gets cooled down immediately, and so we lock in those aromatic compounds into the wort, and then the wort goes off, gets aerated, yeast added, and off to the fermenter. And whereas if you think about a whirlpool process and the traditional method of U.S. breweries and most breweries around the world, but specifically thinking to IPA, when you make that whirlpool hop addition, let's say you have the wort, takes 10 minutes to transfer the wort from your kettle to your whirlpool, which is average for us, fast for some, probably maybe slower than others, but probably it's faster than most. And then the wort will sit for 20 minutes to wait for it to stop spinning. And then for us, it's 30 to 40 minutes to cool our wort down. So you're now well over an hour that those hops have been in contact with the wort. And although we are extracting flavors and whatnot from the hops, we're also losing a lot of those hop aromas, those super delicate hop aromas, which are really volatile at the warm temperature, and they're just going out the kettle stack. And so this is not a novel concept. This is something that Sierra Nevada Brewing Company here in the United States, which I believe just celebrated their 40th anniversary, have been doing forever. And it's something that I saw at Sierra Nevada when I was still a home brewer touring their brewery years ago, decades ago. And it's so it's something that we adopted here, and I really like what it adds to our IPAs. And so that's the foundation of it. So are we leaving something behind in the hops when we discharge them and they just go to the compost bin? We absolutely are. But we also have more control of our aromas and flavors that we're getting from the hops. And we also have more control of our bitterness, because we're also not extracting a lot of bitterness from the hops at this point. And then we're not losing the aroma because we have less contact time. And for us, we like it. It may not be, you know, the best process for every brewery, but for us it works really well. And we have and like I said, that's not unique to us, but it is somewhat unique in the industry in the U.S. because you do have very few breweries using whole cone hops. And I think for us it's about 17% or 18% of our total hop purchases are whole cone. When you get to the dry hop stage of the our brewing process for IPA. We, for the most part, are always dry hopping after fermentation is complete. We've removed as much yeast as we can from the cone of the tank. We add the hops to the top of the tank. And then we usually will do a pH adjustment at this point. So before the hops go in, we'll adjust the pH of the beer down with food grade phosphoric acid. And that's because what we now know from hops is that for every pound per barrel of hops that we dry hop, we raise the pH of the beer on average of 0.1. So again, the pH will go up on average 0.1. So it's really 0.08 to 0.14, depending on the hop variety, but let's just say it's 0.1. So for every pound per barrel we dry hop, we're taking the pH up by 0.1. So if the, you know, end of fermentation is, the beer is, say, 4.3, and we dry hop at 3 pounds per barrel, we're going to probably go from 4.3 to 4.6 pH. And at 4.6 pH, we have a hard time reducing the diacetyl from hop creep. Hop creep's the secondary fermentation that we see from the enzymes in the hops. And so the enzymes break down the residual long chain sugars, which are, you know, adding sweetness and body to the beer. And then we have a secondary fermentation. We have a spike in VDK or diacetyl. And so if we're not lower in pH, the yeast has a hard time reducing that. And so we make this phosphoric acid, you know, addition to lower the pH to counter the rise in pH we get from dry hopping. And then this in turn helps us get through the dry hop process quicker. And then we also have a unique process in dry hopping that all of our fermenters here at our big production brewery have a port on the back of the tank on the cone where we can insert a mixer. The brand is called Guth, G-U-T-H. It's a German company, but we can get them here, and they're pretty readily used in the wine industry. And so we'll mix the tank with a portable, flexible stainless steel impeller mixer, and this gets the hops integrated into the beer more quickly, and we get more extraction out of the hops as well.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And as far as I understand, it's a lot about two things. It's extraction on one side, but also transformation on the other side. And so in terms of the whole hop cones, that means if you have this shorter contact time with the whole hop cones, you also have less transformation of these aromas and more extraction of these first very volatile, very, very specific aromas. And maybe that's the explanation why you have so different aromas on that side than if you would use it the, let's say, classic way. And in general, we now have a lot of experiments here in terms of the biotransformation. Are you also experimenting with that on the last side in the beer?
Yeah, and I'll also add, just to clarify, that on the dry hop side, we are using pellets. So we're using pellets on the dry hop, but we are using whole cones. So yeah, your explanation is correct on the hot side. But yeah, pellets. And then we also use a lot of concentrated pellets. So they, you know, go by different brand names, whether it's Cryo or CGX. And, you know, Haas has their version as well as Steiner. So we're using those as well, which we see helps reduce hop creep. But anyways, back to biotransformation. You know, that's something that we, it's still a pretty big buzzword, at least here in the United States craft beer world amongst small breweries that are focused on IPA. It's not something we've really looked too deep at because I think it's a very, very difficult thing to quantify whether you have it or not, because most breweries will talk about biotransformation based on academia saying that it does or does not work with this yeast or that yeast and at this point in the process. But, you know, if you're a small brewery and you don't have the ability to then do a side-by-side brew that doesn't have that same process, you know what I'm saying, to do a control and then do whatever your process is to try to trigger biotransformation, how do you really know if you're having biotransformation or not? And, you know, let's also call a spade that here in the States, you know, it's that typical American mindset, if a little is good, a lot's better. And, you know, when I started out brewing at my first brewery in Southern California that was called Blind Pig, which is now our main IPA brand outside of Pliny the Elder. It's our single IPA, if you will. It's our number two selling beer now. It was revolutionary to dry hop at 1 pound per barrel. Now, 1 pound per barrel is, you know, if you're not talking about concentrated pellets or anything like that, just straight T90 pellets, 1 pound per barrel here in the United States is pedestrian. It's not a huge dry hop load. I mean, you have breweries whose average dry hop load is 4 pounds per barrel, 5 pounds per barrel, albeit these are small breweries, but still, like, they are, it is sizable amount of hops that are going in. And so I bring this up because, you know, is it really biotransformation that we're seeing, or is it just the sheer volume of hops that we're adding to the beer, and you're just creating these super intense aromas and flavors?
Good question. and really also great difference to the German amounts of hops, which are normally used for beers here.
Yeah, and I don't mean to like downplay biotransformation. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that most people that talk about it probably haven't been able to do, you know, research and do a side by side with or without whatever that process is. And I guess from that standpoint, I'm just a little more scientifically minded. I mean, I'm definitely a very artistic brewer, but there needs to be science behind it as well. And at the end of the day, I just feel like, you know what, if the process we're doing works and it tastes and smells great, then that's fine. And I'm good with that.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Sierra Nevada, and I think for me, maybe the big difference is if you look at the iconic Sierra Nevada products like the Pale Ale or the Torpedo Extra IPA, these were still based on, let's say, a British-like idea with crystal malt and all that. And I think you were one of the first to remove these crystal malts and like open the canvas for the hops. Is that right, or was there something in between?
Yeah, that's the one thing even early on, if I look all the way back to Blind Pig, where I still have my old brew log recipes, you know, yes, we did use some crystal malt in our IPAs and my IPAs, but it was a very small percentage, 2-3% of crystal 15 or crystal 40. And we did this for a long time, but even when the rest of the US craft beer industry was growing with IPAs, most breweries were making their IPAs much higher in crystal malt, much like what you had mentioned with like Sierra Nevada, Torpedo and whatnot. And yes, their IPA and a lot of other large craft breweries' IPAs are still have some crystal malt. And whereas we were always on the lower end, so our beers always popped a little bit more. We certainly weren't the first brewery to explore removing it completely, but it's something that we did many, many, many years ago. And, you know, I think of, and you may have some listeners that say, well, aren't your consumers, your customers, you know, used to what that flavor profile is? And yes, to one extent, but, you know, I think our consumer is also open-minded enough that if we can make the beer better, then that is good for them as well. And I've always thought of our recipes as more concepts rather than a concrete recipe that is just locked in and we can't make changes to it. You'd be shocked if you looked at the Pliny the Elder recipe from 20 years ago to what it is now. The main through line is the two-row base malt. There's sugar added for a drier beer for the fermentation, and that also helps us reduce the fan levels, the free amino nitrogen. But also the other only like main through lines is the Simcoe hop, and then Amarillo being the number two hop. Past that, you know, all the hops are much different. In fact, we just recently added in a brand new hop called Tangier and dropped out a few hop varieties. You know, it's always been a citrus-focused driven flavor profile along with pine and stone fruit. And so this new hop Tangier allows us to get a nice orange quality, citrus quality, as opposed to having to blend a few hops together. So I'm always looking, and I do a lot of work in our pilot brewery on, you know, new hop varieties to try to think about how we can incorporate them into the beer. And one of the ways to make the flavor and aroma in an IPA pop is to really just use a clean canvas. And yes, most smaller to mid-sized breweries here in the States are not using crystal malt in their IPA. They're using either Pilsner or two-row malt as the base, and sometimes with or without a percentage of dextrose sugar, as well as part of the fermentation mix. Now, with that said, you also need to look who your clientele is and your market. And for us, our market and the people we sell to are, you know, are open-minded enough, and they trust Russian River Brewing Company. They trust the quality of our beer. They trust that every time they buy a bottle or can of our beer, it's going to be super high quality. But they also trust in all the R&D and the pilot work, the work I do in our pilot brewery to make our beers better. And we've always been very transparent about it. We've never been secretive about the fact that we are often, you know, trialing things in the pilot brewery. And if they work out, they will eventually work their way into our beer. But I also think that's what's kept us relevant. You know, Russian River Brewery is, you know, now 26 or 27 years old. I can't even remember. So we've been around a long time. And, you know, one of the things that has kept us relevant, and so let's talk about Pliny the Elder, our, you know, number one selling beer, our double IPA, is that the recipe has evolved with the palate. And so at least for our customers, they want a, they want to follow where we're going, which is making the beer drier, making it more hop forward. Whereas someone larger who has more of a wider audience and a broader audience, like Sierra Nevada or New Belgium or whoever, you know, they may still stick with the model of putting crystal malt in their IPA because they're marketing to a broader audience who maybe wants a little more sweetness, you know, in the beer. And that's one of the things that that ingredient is going to give. I was just at the Craft Beer and Brewing Brewers Retreat, it was at Sierra Nevada Mills River. And one of the other guest breweries there is from Florida. And he was talking about the IPAs he makes and how he still has more of an old school IPA, and what he was referring to was that it still has some crystal malt in it because that's what his customers want. And so it's important to not just move your recipe because it's, you know, it's what you want. You do still need to know that your customer is going to, you know, be open to that. And that's one of the great things about having, we have two brew pubs. So each of our brewery locations have a restaurant attached to it, is that we have direct communication with the customer. And so I can make a beer and we have a brand that's R&D. So capital R, lowercase n, and then capital D. So like research and development. And anytime a customer sees R&D on the chalkboard, they know that I made that beer in our little 5-barrel pilot brewery. And so our bartenders and servers can get direct feedback, and then I can extract that feedback from our front of house team and learn, you know, like, well, did they like this? Was this too much? Was there not enough flavor? So on and so forth.
Maybe this is even the biggest challenge, because if I think back to the days in Berlin, I wrote a book about all the Berlin craft breweries like 15 years ago. And when I came back 5 years ago and we're talking to those who were iconic 15 years ago, most of them said, okay, it was great when we started, when all the craft beer idea in Germany, in Berlin started, people came in every day, wanted to have the new beer, the new shit, and try the next day something different and whatever. It was like a roller coaster. And now, 10 years later, they don't look at us anymore because we are now the old guys and we are the guys that have been there. So they go to other ones, to newer ones, which make more releases, more whatever things. And I think that is quite tough to, on one side, be innovative and productive and go to these demands, and on the other side, to keep something, some iconic, some continuous beers like other breweries in Germany, which are existing for 600 years, more or less doing the same beers all this time and still on the market. So I think that's really a difference or a challenge if you start a new brewery like 25 years ago and find a way to be on one side still these new guys, which make the interesting trendy stuff, and the others on the other side to have a business with a customer base which are used to specific beers and like them once and once again and stick on the brand.
You just hit the nail on the head. What keeps Natalie and I up at night, and why I was up at 3:30 this morning laying in bed, because I'm always thinking about what I can do to our beers to keep them relevant and keep them focused and keep the consumer's focus on us. There is a trend here in the United States for many small breweries to not have a flagship beer, meaning they don't have one main beer that represents them. I feel, and Natalie the same way, we feel very fortunate that we have a beer like Pliny the Elder that is our number one beer that represents 60 or 65% of our total volume production. It makes planning much easier, but it also gives us a lot of different batches to keep making it better and better, just like, the German breweries you mentioned, that only make a handful of beers. There's something really magical about being able to brew the same beer over and over again and dial it in and get your process down. And I love that. And I'm happy that we have, that and that, really four or five of our beers represent like 98 or 95% of our total volume, with one of those being 60 or 65%.
Yeah, when I was talking to Jamie Bogner maybe a year ago, we were, of course, also talking about the IPAs and the development of the IPA and the pale ale. And he mentioned that more and more breweries start to more or less brew them as lagers, so use lager yeast, and so change the whole idea of that. Do you have an idea about that?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. We're doing a collaboration with a brewery in Los Angeles called Highland Park in January that arguably was the one that brought this to the forefront. Interestingly, Matt Brennelson from Firestone Walker and I have talked about this on and off over the years, but Bob Kuntz at Highland Park is the one that really brought this to fruition and has a really great story, and albeit they're very small brewery, he's also the one that brought West Coast Pils to the forefront, and would actually be a really interesting interview for you to chat with him, because it's a modern version of Pilsner with an IPA flavor profile. So he ferments all of his IPAs with lager yeast. So you are starting your fermentation cooler, but not as cold as a classic Pilsner or Helles or whatever other lager style, but definitely cooler than if you were using an ale yeast. And so we do make some IPAs where we are using lager yeast for that fermentation. And what you get is a even cleaner fermentation profile. Less esters, which again, here in the States, breweries are trying to have a super clean malt foundation, a really clean yeast contribution, and then let the hops really pop. And then you continue the process as if it's an IPA, and the beer warms up through the fermentation so that when you're dry hopping, you're up to dry hop temperature, which is 68 Fahrenheit or 20 C. And off you go. Now you do have more sulfur. You have a little bit more sulfur, but that's not a bad thing, because with that extra sulfur, you have a little more shelf stability. It's acting as a preservative. But I do know that some breweries also fight a little acetaldehyde in their IPA when they are fermenting with lager yeast. So there it's really a balance of not fermenting too cold, but fermenting warm enough to where you're blowing off some of these quote unquote off flavors, but also cold enough to where you're achieving what you're trying to achieve, which is a cold fermentation to have a really clean platform. So we do this, but it's not our regular process. Our regular yeast for our IPAs is Chico yeast, which is, of course, a reference to Sierra Nevada Brewing Company and the yeast that they started with. And rumor is that yeast originally came from the Ballantine Brewery, which is an old IPA brewery, which has some great history in the middle of the mid US. I actually don't know if that's totally true, and I'm not even sure if Ken knows that or not, but regardless, it's a workhorse of an IPA, and it's sort of the equivalent of 3470, but on the ale side. It actually ferments quite cold for an ale yeast. It can ferment warmer. It's pretty clean. Yes, it does have some ester contribution, but not a huge amount if you ferment it on the lower end of its spectrum, you know, and 3470 is kind of that same way. You can ferment it really cold. You can ferment it warmer. They're just both super flexible yeasts that are, I'd say they're related in the sense that they have that ability to really be flexible in how the brewer wants to use them.
Yeah, and there is some logic behind it. If you think that maybe American IPA started with bringing it more and more hop forward. So first you reduce the crystal malt, so the malty part, make it more like a canvas for the hops, and then you may even reduce yeast aromas to have even more space for the hops, which is somehow logic for me. So interesting. And now we have a lot of like cold IPAs and all that stuff here also, which we get from the States, and many nice beers among them. In general, I think the change in the beer world, at least in Europe, but probably also in the States, also goes another way, because people are drinking less, or at least different. Also, they maybe have less money, or they spend less money, and they want alternative drinks like kombucha and hop water and whatever things. So in general, the alcohol consumption goes down and the interest on alcoholic beer goes down. Do you have this also at your brewery, and are you developing other products too?
You know, the only alternative thing that we make is hop water, at least right now. I mentioned that we add some advanced hop products. They're flowable liquid extracted hops, so basically super concentrated hops into a flowable form for some of our beers. So that replaces some of the T90 pellets, and we have reasons for doing that. But and you can take some of those same products and make hop water and make a really clean, nice, easy drinking hop water. That's really the only thing we do. We don't make non-alcoholic beer. We don't make seltzer or, FMBs, so flavored malt beverages. Those things just aren't in our purview. Our real focus is just staying in our lane. We know what we're good at. We know that we can always do better. We never rest on our laurels. Natalie and I always say that we run our business with a little bit of paranoia. We're always looking over our shoulder, always thinking that someone can do better. And that's what drives us to keep making better and better beer and be more sustainable and do all the things we do that keeps our business healthy. You know, we're going to have 5% growth this year. We had 7% growth last year and a couple percent growth the year before. In the history of Russian River Brewery, there's only been one or two years when we haven't had any growth. And I'm also a firm believer that to be successful, you don't need to just keep growing. You know, the wine industry here proves that every year, that you can be a 10,000 case winery and do that year after year after year and not grow. You find other ways to, you raise your prices a little bit, you find efficiencies, so on and so forth. And so, for us, our business is pretty healthy, given the climate, and we're very, humbled and honored that folks will continue to buy our beer even after all these years. But we also work our butts off to do that. But we also have made sure that we're staying in our lane, like I just said a minute ago. And staying in our lane means that we don't need to make seltzer. And I don't have any issue with anyone making seltzers or kombucha or whatever you have to do to survive. If that's what you need to do and your customer's buying it, great, but it's just not who we are. I have made, or I shouldn't say made, I've attempted to make non-alcoholic beer three times in our pilot brewery. By the third time, it tasted as good as most of the major NA beers here in the States, but it didn't taste any better. And with that in mind, you know, we haven't released any NA beer. I've dumped them all. Would I like to have a non-alcoholic beer for our two brew pubs? I would. I would like to have one that we make, but until I can make one that meets, you know, what I think I want the flavor to be, we will continue to buy a non-alcoholic beer from another brewery. So we serve Firestone Walker's 805, which I think is one of the best non-alcoholic beers here in the States. And I'm fine with that because they can make a better version of it than we can make. And but like I said, we'll just stay in our lane and just try to keep focusing on making all of our beers better and have better shelf stability, flavor stability, aroma stability, all that stuff.
First of all, it's great to hear that your business is doing well. So I'm very happy about that. And second, I think it's maybe the first time I ever hear from an American brewer that not the main focus is not to grow. For me, that was always the big difference between most of the brewers I know here in my area in Franconia, because if you ask them, they would never say we want to grow, because they produce what they can produce and they are always on that level, and they won't make more, and they sell everything they produce, and that's good for them. And when I went to the States, always the first or at least the second sentence was, okay, we have that plan of that growth and then we sell and whatever. And so for me, that was always a big difference, and I'm very, very, very happy to hear that also that thinking is there somewhere at least. That's great.
Yeah, all the growth we've had, this you know, 3-5% growth, it's all been organic. Like, it's not forced. We don't tell our sales director you must, you know, find 5% more growth. It's just her telling Natalie and I, well, this is where the market's going. And if, you know, she came to us and said, we don't have anywhere to, you know, there isn't anywhere to grow, that's fine too. In fact, that's what I expect every year. And we're actually pushing up against our, you know, total capacity here at the brewery. And we aren't looking to add more tanks and grow. And that's actually what got a lot of breweries in trouble, is that they grew too fast and they invested too much. And then that, you know, loan payment was just too much to handle, and they closed. And it's really sad here in the States right now. There's a lot of breweries closing, small and large, and a lot of old iconic brands that are closing, going out of business. And those, you know, that's somebody's dream. That's someone's business that's closing. And although there are probably too many breweries here in the States right now, It sucks for somebody in their business.
Yeah, I was very shocked. The last I heard about was Rogue.
That's the most recent one, and before that, 21st Amendment. And when we were designing our big production brewery here in Windsor, California, which is just a short, like, 10-minute drive from our brew pub in Santa Rosa, where we also brew, and most people think of Russian River. One of the technical consultants we were using, he would, you know, when we laid out what our, it's someone we've known in the industry for years, but when he really got to know Natalie and I, and he's Belgian, he's Flemish, so, you know, he has that idea of like Trappist monasteries, he knows all about that. Floris would always say, you and Natalie, you're like monks. Like, you don't grow your business. You're not into growing your business. You think more like a monk does with, you know, with the Trappist breweries that make beer. And I always thought that was funny, and wore it with a badge of honor. So
Yeah, but there is a lot of truth in it. one thing I have to ask for a friend who is a very skilled home brewer and he has a lot of barrels where he is experimenting with and he uses a thing he calls the Winnie Nail. And I think that refers to you. And he asked me if I ever can talk to you, I have to ask you if there is a story behind that.
Yeah. So to give you a little background, I guess my claim to fame in the beer industry is the double IPA, because I'm credited with making the first modern double IPA in the beer industry back in 1994. And then the second thing is the Vinny Nail, so named after me. So essentially, when we started making barrel aged beers, I didn't have a way, I was to pull a sample out. And if you know anything about doing like wild barrel aged beer specifically, which is what we do and what we're known for, when you add the Brettanomyces, you form a pellicle or a film yeast on the top. So if you use a traditional wine thief to pull a sample out, you break the pellicle, and that's not good because the pellicle is what protects the beer from too much oxygen. And with the pellicle, the only oxygen you're getting is the micro-oxygenation through the wood. So the thought was to drill a hole in the head of the barrel, and then I stick a stainless steel nail in the head of the barrel. And so you then use a hammer, the backside of a hammer, to pull the nail out. And then you have a cup and the sample just trickles out of the nail. And you can kind of control the flow by if the bung is in and or not, and the barrel is vented, and then you put the nail back in. It's always important to have an extra nail in your pocket, or I tuck it into my watch band. Funny story, Natalie gave me an iWatch for Christmas a few years ago, and it's got a stainless steel band that I can pull tight, and that's where I stick the nail. So it's a use of my iWatch that I didn't know that I would actually, you know, use for that reason. But you pull the sample, and the beer comes out, and it's below the level of the pellicle. And so that's the reason behind it and how it got started and why I did it originally. I had looked at a bunch of different things that you could use to put in to that hole, and most were either too big or they were too clumsy or it just wasn't the right fit. But a nail, a stainless steel nail, was perfect.
Absolutely. And it really works perfect, even in my friend's cellar. So that's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it works. It works well. And I'll be honest, I chuckle to myself whenever I see a picture of, you know, in a beer magazine or a story about, you know, someone pulling a sample, and they pull the nail, as it's called, and they're taking their sample. And I'd think back to just how like simple and utilitarian and why I did it. And we're really, you know, that's another part of our business that's growing again. Our sour, wild, funky beer program. All these beers age in used wine barrels, or we have fooders, so upright wooden tanks that we've bought from wineries that didn't have a use for them anymore. You know, these beers were once about 10 or even 12% of our total beer sales. And then, from probably 2018 to 2022, so through the pandemic, they dropped. And, you know, back in the 2010 to 2015, it seemed like every brewery, at least in California, was making some form of a wild beer. So to some degree, our sales got diluted just by other people making them. But slowly and little by little, as other breweries stopped making them, and we're one of the only breweries that distributes our wild beers throughout the whole state of California, where we sell 80% of our beer in total just in California. I mean, it's 40 million people live here. It's a small country in and of itself. So we have a huge marketplace and an audience. Those sales have gone back up, and we can almost like can't keep the wild beers in stock. But the difference is we're selling a lot more draft wild beer instead of bottles, which is fine. We'll take it either way. And I'm just excited that people are still drinking these types of beers, and they're curious about it. And again, you know, as a lot of these breweries that were doing it have dropped out of this part of the market, the overall quality of the wild beers being sold out in the marketplace has gone up, because those of us that are still making it, like the Lost Abbey, Beechwood, Little Brewery in Southern California, and there's you know, like Allagash on the East Coast from Portland, Maine, and there's many more that are still in the game, but the quality level is up again, because everyone that's left already was already making super high quality wild, you know, funky barrel aged beer, and here we are again. Those same breweries are now the ones left, and the quality is there, and that's really exciting.
It's about quality and innovation in a way. I know our hour is coming to an end, but I have two points I want to spotlight a little bit. One is the alternative grains idea. So you had this project with Garrett Oliver about Phonio, and I would just be curious or be interested about your experiences with Phonio and how it went and if there is a continuation on that.
Yeah, I love that. Was such a great project, and we absolutely love Garrett and all he's doing. And you know, if your listeners don't know about the Michael Jackson Foundation, I encourage them to look it up on the internet and all the good work he's doing there. And then he's got this Phonio project that started out with Natalie and I trying some of his Phonio beers in 2019, and then last year he asked us to be a part of the Brewing for Impact collaboration, which was a global collaboration that also included Guinness and Carlsberg. And we were lucky enough to be the one U.S. brewery they asked to be a part of it. And so we made a Belgian blonde ale that was inspired by a blonde ale that we were drinking at West Vleteren, their blonde, back in 2022, when Garrett, Natalie, and I were traveling together in Belgium. And so we kind of used that as the inspiration and made a Belgian blonde ale that had 30% Phonio. And it went over really well in the marketplace. And we even used Phonio in our kitchens at the pubs. And so if your listeners don't know, Phonio is an ancient Western African grain that's 5,000 years old that has the ability to grow virtually in sand without any irrigation, no fertilizer, no pesticides, no insecticides, so on and so forth. It really is an incredible grain, has great flavor. When you eat it, it has this kind of nutty quality to it. But in beer, it comes off as being like a lychee fruit or a Sauvignon Blanc white grape type flavor. It's really cool. So even past that project, we've continued to use it. We use it in our saison that's called Robert. We make a blonde ale that we actually have the Phonio blonde ale on right now. And we've continued to tweak the recipe, but that's now just using our Chico yeast. So it's a really clean beer, has the color of like an industrial lager, because the Phonio lightens the color up so much. We're using a little bit of Nelson hops from New Zealand to kind of, it melds well with those flavors from the Phonio. And we're using 30% Phonio in the grain bill. This year, 2026 coming up, we have a partnership with Whole Foods where they're going to be featuring our Phonio beer in all of the Whole Foods that we sell in, mostly here in California, but a couple of the other states we ship to as well, that they're going to have this focused on Earth Day, which is in April. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, we've continued to use it, and I'm super excited and really just happy for Garrett and honored that he asked us to be a part of the project. And it really got us into using it.
Yeah, that's really great to hear. And I must say, I tried some of the beers he made with the Senegalese brewer in Africa. And I was really surprised.
The Phonio Guinness was amazing. That was my favorite of all the ones I tried.
Unfortunately, I haven't tried that, but maybe there is the opportunity in the future. The other point I want to talk about a little is you are just installing a CO2 recovery equipment at your facility. And I would be curious about how was the decision on that and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Yeah, that was 7 years ago when we started building our production brewery, our big production brewery, we decided that we were going to install CO2 recovery down the line. And so we designed it into the facility, but couldn't afford to put it in then. In hindsight, that was a blessing in disguise, because there's been so much more advancement for small CO2 recovery equipment from just 7 years ago to now. So in the end, we went with Dalum, D-A-L-U-M, just an absolute amazing company. And we are really thrilled with what we have. So yeah, we did a lot. I did a lot of research the last few years, and then last year and into early this year, we installed all the hard piping and whatnot ourselves, and then they came in and helped us install the equipment. And so we're now 100% off the grid. We don't buy CO2 anymore. We send CO2 to our Santa Rosa pub as well. We've even sold CO2 because we have an excess CO2. We've sold CO2 to another local brewery. And since July 23rd, which is the day we turned it on, we've collected about 225,000 pounds of CO2. So it's pretty exciting, and something Natalie and I have always wanted to do. We have a lot of sustainability built into our brewery. We have a wastewater treatment plant that treats all of the, it's a pre-treatment that treats all the brewery effluent. Most of that water gets treated at the end and refiltered and comes back into the building. And that's our cleaning water for all the brewing. So our CIP is all reclaimed water. The whole landscape of our property is watered with recycled, non-potable recycled water from our municipality. None of the rainwater leaves our property. It all goes into the ground and then naturally into the aquifers, or it flows out the wetlands that we have. Someday we'll be able to run all of our toilets on the recycled water once some of the regulations change here in the state, and then solar would be the very last thing we do down the line. And we picked solar last because it's the most expensive.
Fantastic to hear, and really interesting how big the change was between the first days when you started and the challenges then and what you have now. And that also leads me to maybe my last question. So if you would sit down with your younger self at the very start of your brewery journey, what would you say to yourself after all that perspective?
Yeah, that's shocking that we've got to where we are. I would have never thought that, you know, we would be a 50,000 barrel brewery. We did it very slowly, but thrilled, with what we'd done. But yeah, just a total surprise. I didn't think that we'd ever be at this level. I remember going to Sierra Nevada as a home brewer and seeing the brewery and how pretty and shiny it was, and just how tight it was and immaculate and efficient, and just like, I would have never thought that we would have had a facility like that. And we're humbled that people drink our beer the way they do, and honored that we're still relevant and in people's conversations about beer. So yeah, I think younger Vinny would have been shocked that to see what beer has done for us.
And not only for you, also for us. I'm a really big fan. So thank you very, very much for your time, for the information.
Yeah, I hope you can come visit us sometime. Yes. And maybe come out for our Pliny the Younger triple IPA release someday.
I will do my best. Thank you very much and have a nice day.
Take care.
Beer Talk, der Podcast rund ums Bier. Alle Folgen unter www.biertalk.de.